The Guardian.
Guardian Daily. News from The Guardian.
Hello, it's Monday, February the 25th. This is Guardian Daily. My name's John Dennis. Today, police investigating child abuse in Jersey excavate a former children's home. It's feared they may find several bodies.
The police have told us today they think there might be up to six other possible burial sites in that Victorian mansion.
The Independent Police Complaints Commission is failing in its duty to investigate complaints, and it's biased towards the police. That's according to a Guardian investigation. And Cuba has a new head of state today after 49 years of Fidel Castro. But before we get too carried away,
while he retains a living breath in his body, he's going to clip the wings of any attempts to reform the economy or to dilute the purity of the revolution as he would see it.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis from guardian.co.uk.
Before any of that, let's have the news and a roundup of today's papers with Sandy Waugh.
At the Oscars, the Irish-British actor Daniel Day-Lewis won Best Actor for playing an oil tycoon in There Will Be Blood. It's his second award. The first was for My Left Foot. Another British winner was actress Tilda Swinton, who won Best Supporting Actress. The full story later in Guardian Daily. In Cuba, former President Fidel Castro's brother Raúl has been made president by the National Assembly. Raúl's been caretaker for more than a year during his brother's illness, so his takeover was expected. Cyprus has elected its first communist president, a 61-year-old history professor. He said that his main aim is to unify the island for both Turks and Greeks, and he has the support of the Turkish Cypriot leader. Police in Jersey are searching six more sites at a former children's home after finding the remains of a child. They're using sniffer dogs but are searching under concrete floors. More details later in our programme. Most of the papers cover that search, with The Times interviewing a former children's home worker who was sacked for complaining that child abuse was going on. The Guardian leads with its exclusive story of a crisis at the Independent Police Complaints Commission, where over 100 lawyers have resigned. We'll have full details in Guardian Daily. All the papers report that the Speaker of the House of Commons, Michael Martin, is under pressure to resign over expenses. The Sun headlines it, out of order, order. And of course, all the back pages carry Tottenham's win over Chelsea in the Carling Cup. All white now, says the Mail.
Detectives in Jersey are looking for more bodies in a former children's home where the remains of one child have already been found. A sniffer dog has focused the police on one particular area of the Haute de la Garenne building. Stephen Morris has been reporting on the story for The Guardian. He says the police believe they may find more bodies.
They've got two reasons, really, John. One is they've got a highly trained sniffer dog who's been going around this mansion and trying to find what they call hot spots, places where they feel a body may be buried. Alongside that, they've also got high-tech equipment, which means they can look for spaces where the earth has been disturbed. And those two things are tallying, and they think there's evidence that ground has been disturbed and there might be space for more bodies there.
One child's remains have already been discovered. What do we know about who this was?
We know very little at the moment, John, and the police know very little either. The body was found, or the remains, rather, were found on Saturday morning. It's going to take them several weeks even to establish the sex and the age of the child. They've got no idea at the moment who the child is. They're looking back over records, but it's going to be a painstaking search.
Why did the police decide to begin excavating the building?
Well, this all goes back to a year-long investigation to allegations of child abuse on Jersey. It all started after the police were looking into allegations against some Sea Cadet Corps officers who'd allegedly been abusing children. After that case, they started seeing some links between that and this children's home. So for a year, they covertly investigated, asked a few discreet questions. Then last November went public and said, "We think there's been a problem here. Please come forward if you think you may have been a victim of abuse." They've had 140 people come forward. And out of those 140 people, I think it's three that have said, "We think there may be bodies buried at that house. You ought to take a look."
So we're looking at the possibility that we could have a real house of horrors on Jersey.
It's looking that way. The police have told us today they think there might be up to 6 other possible burial sites in that Victorian mansion.
And can you tell us something about the history of this mansion?
It was built back in 1867. At the time, it was called the Industrial School for young people of the lower classes of society and neglected children. It later became known as the Haute de la Garenne, and much more a children's home as we would think of one. In the mid-80s, about 1986, it was closed and turned into a nice 100-bed youth hostel.
And, 140 people, I mean, this could have been child abuse on a massive scale.
Well, yes, it goes back. The police think that it was back to the 60s, 70s, 80s, maybe a little bit in the 90s. But we've also spoken to people today who know a little bit about the case, who think there may be victims going back to the end of the Second World War.
Why has this only just come to light?
Well, that's what we'll seek to find out, and the police will be seeking to find out. There are allegations are being made that the authorities on Jersey really haven't been looking closely enough on how these children's homes are run, and that people have been able to get away with awful treatment of children.
Steve Morris reporting, and there's breaking news from Jersey today at guardian.co.uk/crime.
Guardian Daily. News from The Guardian.
Also on The Guardian's website today, Andrew Clark reports from New York on why Starbucks is closing all of its 7,100 outlets in the United States tomorrow afternoon so that it can teach its staff, 35,000 of them, about coffee. Not before time, some might say. Read about that at guardian.co.uk/America. How the reconstructed fragments of a diary shed light on the horror of the Warsaw Ghetto. That's at guardian.co.uk/international. And Eliane Glazer on maternal ambivalence. Parenting is not a natural gift, she argues. It's an imperfect business, and you learn it on the job. Tell us what you think by posting a comment at guardian.co.uk/commentisfree. Oh, and memo to self, don't forget Mother's Day this Sunday. More than 100 lawyers who specialise in handling complaints to the police have resigned en masse. They say that the Independent Police Complaints Commission is not independent enough, and it doesn't investigate complaints. Nick Davies has been investigating the shortcomings of the IPCC for The Guardian. He told Guardian Daily's Andy Duckworth what the lawyers are saying.
The interesting thing is that these specialist lawyers who handle complaints to the police originally welcomed this new Independent Police Complaints Commission, and they've resigned en masse because even though on paper the IPCC looks pretty good, in practice they're saying it's one administrative failure after another. So they're talking about huge delays in settling complaints, which have remained unsettled for years. They're saying that masses of decisions are made by casework managers who turn out to be university graduates with no special training, no relevant experience. So understandably enough, they're getting it wrong. They're saying that the IPCC, which now has its own investigators to handle the most serious cases, are frequently failing to do their job properly. And maybe what's most worrying is they're saying there's a pattern of favouritism towards the police. So the complainant is saying, such and such happened, here's a witness who tends to support the complainant, and the IPCC is saying, well, the police say such and something completely different happened, so we're going with that and we're rejecting the complaint.
And Nick, you've uncovered several case studies, and some people have been waiting 8 years for complaints to be sorted.
Yeah, there's a particular woman I mentioned called Christine Hurst, whose son, who's an adult, was stabbed to death by a neighbour. And after the son died, Mrs. Hurst discovered by making her own inquiries that this neighbour had been threatening her son for many months. And furthermore, she discovered from a police officer that these threats were known about with the local police. And yet on the night that the son died, the family had twice called to the police and said, for heaven's sake, the neighbour's outside with a knife, get here. And the police had said, well, we might prosecute him for harassment, don't know. And the second time they called, the police said, well, we haven't got any officers. We're too short-staffed to come round. So she complained. She said, if the police had acted on their knowledge of these threats, my son would still be alive. And basically that complaint went into the system, got lost for long periods of time, was knocked back without an effective inquiry, and now, 8 years after that lad died, 8 years after Mrs. Hurst put in her complaint, it still hasn't been resolved.
So what's the IPCC saying about all this?
Well, they're saying they're not perfect and they recognise they could do better, but they're saying that the lawyers who've resigned en masse, there's more than 100 of them, are being unfair, and that there are loads of cases where they get things right. They say that they, okay, we get complaints from these specialist lawyers, but also we get complaints from the police federation, so we must be doing something right if we're attracting flack from both sides. But I've replayed that defence of the IPCC back to the lawyers who've resigned, and they, of course, stand by their case that they've got significant problems and that they've been trying to draw attention to them for several years and have got nowhere.
And Nick, there are a couple of ironic parts to this. Firstly, you say there's a lack of impartiality for the Independent Police Complaints Commission, and also the group representing these lawyers has had problems complaining about the IPCC itself.
Yes, so they're going to a body which handles complaints. They're complaining about it, and that complaint itself is not being properly handled. And in fact, I have got some of the internal paperwork that these lawyers have submitted over the last few years. And I mean, some of it is pretty tough stuff. I mean, they stuck in a dossier 2 years ago detailing 12 sample case histories. And the lawyers said in their accompanying note, mediocrity appears to flourish unchecked, unmarked, and in many instances, unacknowledged.
Nick Davies, and you can read Nick's investigation in today's Guardian and, of course, at guardian.co.uk. I'm John Dennis. Still to come on Guardian Daily, Jason Solomons gives his verdict on last night's Oscars. Kevin McCarra tells us what he thinks of yesterday's Carling Cup final. The Radiohead-style restaurant whose customers decide how much their meal is worth. And why the Danish Prime Minister, Anders Fogh Rasmussen, has given a whole new meaning to the phrase running for office.
I'm in Copenhagen going for a run with the Prime Minister of Denmark.
We're going to run around a lake. We will run in a forest and get a lot of wonderful physical exercise.
But first, on Tuesday afternoon, 9-year-old Shannon Matthews failed to return home from school after a swimming trip. She's not been seen since, and the police are gravely concerned for her safety. The Guardian's Martin Wainwright reports from outside Shannon's home in Moorside Road in Dewsbury in West Yorkshire. He found out from Shannon's aunt, Amanda Hyatt, how local people are helping the police search for Shannon.
All we've been doing is just distributing leaflets out, posters, asking anyone if they've seen her, and in Ellen Road, Wakefield, Leeds, Bradford. We're just covering all the areas we possibly can.
I don't want to make silly comparisons, but a lot of people have compared this to Madeleine McCann, you know, the huge amount of publicity that's been generated, and in your own way, you're doing very well. Are you modelling the campaign on that at all?
No, it's totally different. We're a community that hasn't got a lot of money, but we're helping any bit of money we've got, it's going into Shannon. Anybody just wanting to come and help, having teas, coffee, you've had loads of people coming from all over just to search. It's not going to stop till she's found.
No, and you've gone further afield, haven't you? Not just here in Dewsbury.
North Wales tomorrow. We've gone Leeds football.
North Wales, you're going to.
Yeah.
Why is that?
A guy just come in and said, "I'm off to North Wales. Can I have some leaflets?" We've said, "Yeah, sure." And that's all we're doing. Is anybody that wants to take any leaflets, come down. The more, the merrier.
And you've got the languages, you've got English on the poster, you've got Urdu, because it's quite a big Asian community, then you've got Hungarian. Why is that?
You've got different communities living in all one area, so we might as well tackle all the areas of different languages for it to get through.
Good. Well, thanks very much, Amanda. I hope you find her soon. So I'm at the Moorside Community Centre now, and there's a group of women here who've, again, all got T-shirts like Amanda's saying, "Have you seen Shannon Matthews?" And they've stuck the pictures on. Tell me what you're doing to help the search.
Well, like I said this morning, I've been around Dewsbury car boat sale giving out leaflets. We're just giving out leaflets and just asking anybody who, if they've seen her, please phone the police or Crime Stoppers anonymously.
I was saying to Amanda, it must make you all feel good because you're doing something, you're helping, but do you think it'll make a difference?
Well, personally, I don't feel good about it. It's something that we shouldn't be doing. But at the end of the day, someone has got to have seen her.
I imagine you get a good reception from everybody.
We have done, yeah. You can get some negative as well.
Can you?
Not everybody, no.
I went to a woman and I goes, will you take a leaflet? She goes, no, I'm not taking one. It's not my daughter, is it?
No.
So I just went, you're so ignorant. It's a little girl that's gone. And if it were your daughter, we'd all try and do the same if we knew you, you know, or we'd take a leaflet.
It's not even that. You've got people coming from all over that don't know, Shannon, that have come and helped, which have been absolutely brilliant. But you have got some negative that go, well, she's not to do me. Why should I take one? Mm. At the end of the day, you've got anybody that could have seen it. Anybody, there's only that vital information we need just to find her.
That's Amanda Hyatt with other volunteers talking to Martin Wainwright at the community centre in Dewsbury. And you can catch the latest on that story today at guardian.co.uk/UK.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.
Fidel Castro announced last week that he was stepping down as Cuba's president after almost 50 years. Yesterday, the members of Cuba's National Assembly named Fidel's younger brother Raúl Castro as the new head of state. Rory Carroll's our Latin America correspondent. I asked him if anybody will notice the difference.
Well, that's a very good question. Not really in some ways, because this officially puts an end to this strange interregnum we've had since Fidel Castro fell sick 19 months ago and withdrew from power. And officially this now transfers power to Raúl and casts him now into the spotlight. However, effectively we've had Raúl as the de facto president for almost the past 2 years anyway. And certainly from the kind of almost subdued atmosphere during the vote yesterday and a certain kind of apparent normality on the streets of Havana yesterday, there appeared to be no outward difference.
Fidel Castro is still first secretary of the ruling Communist Party. How much real political power does Fidel now hold in Cuba?
Well, that's an enduring enigma because we don't actually really know how much power he's had over the last 19 months since he fell ill. And it's not obvious now to how much more power he's going to wield or influence he's going to wield behind the scenes in the future. So really, I mean, the short answer is we just don't know. I think he's still going to remain an ideological guiding light. And the likelihood is while he retains a living breath in his body, he's going to clip the wings of any attempts to reform the economy or to dilute the purity of the revolutionists. He would see it.
Although Raúl isn't seen as very ideologically driven, is he, compared to Fidel anyway?
That's right. Compared to Big Brother, Raúl is seen as a pragmatist. He's seen as a guy who's kind of surrounds himself with technocrats and like-minded senior army officers who realise that the main issue for the future in Cuba and for the revolution is the economy. And that means putting food in people's bellies. It means reducing the daily grind, which has people eking an existence on $16 a month, which is the average wage there. And they realise that their future and the future of the revolution hinges on being able to make daily life just that bit much easier for ordinary people.
Raúl's only a few years younger than Fidel, of course. How soon before we're discussing the possible successor to him?
Well, I think that's already begun, actually. Already we're looking to the next generation of leaders because, as you said, Raúl is now, he's 76. His health, we think, is fine, but already we're looking now for the battle beneath Raúl between the kind of a younger generation of reformers who certainly would envisage a sort of a Chinese-style opening, which is trying to retain the control of the Communist Party whilst liberalising the economy. And then there'd be another generation of people who are also young but are also more ideologically pure in the Fidel mold, and they are the ones who want to try to keep the revolution pure, and so there's going to be this battle now taking place beneath him between these two factions, and to what extent he's going to be able to control them will pretty much determine the next year or two of Cuba's history.
And this time next year, of course, we'll have a new president in the White House. Are there any signs of rapprochement towards the United States?
Well, certainly Raúl Castro in the past few months has twice offered an olive branch to Washington, saying, look, you know, this embargo, economic embargo you've used against us, it hasn't worked. We're still here. We're still standing. And that you can do business with me is the signal he's been sending, partly because of the strength of the Cuban American lobby in Miami. None of the main contenders to the U.S. presidency have actually accepted this olive branch. Barack Obama is one who signals the kind of most pragmatic approach, saying that he would be willing to meet the leadership, probably without preconditions, whereas Hillary and John McCain are sticking to their traditional guns of saying they're not going to negotiate until and unless the revolution basically winds itself up.
Rory Carroll. It was billed as a vintage year for the Oscars, although the ceremony itself very nearly didn't happen at all because of the Hollywood writers' strike. But there were some universally acclaimed films in contention this year, with Paul Thomas Anderson's There Will Be Blood and the Coen brothers' No Country for Old Men, each nominated in 8 categories. To tell us whether the 2008 Academy Awards lived up to expectations, our critic Jason Solomons.
Hollywood was the golden country for the Coen brothers last night as their film No Country for Old Men scooped 4 Oscars, including the big 2, Best Director and Best Film. It held off stiff competition right to the last from There Will Be Blood, which managed just 2 awards in the end for actor Daniel Day-Lewis and Best Cinematography for Robert Elswit. The Coens' victory signals the acceptance into the Hollywood mainstream of the famously quirky pair who've previously had success with Fargo, Barton Fink and The Big Lebowski, for example, though nothing like this headline-grabbing feat. No Country for Old Men also earned Best Supporting Actor for Spaniard Javier Bardem, who played the film's oddly coiffed but deadly assassin, Anton Chigurh, a win that made him, incidentally, the first Spanish actor ever to win an Oscar. It was a night of few surprises, with perhaps the biggest shock coming in the Best Actress category, where France's Marion Cotillard held off favourite Julie Christie to win for her playing of Edith Piaf in La Vie en Rose. It was, however, a repeat of her win at the BAFTAs earlier this month and came 2 days after her win at the César, France's own film awards. Cotillard thus became the first French actress to win an Oscar since Simone Signoret won in 1960 for her role in a British film, A Room at the Top. Although Joe Wright's film Atonement missed out on all but one of its 7 nominations, it won for Dario Marinelli's Best Original Score, it wasn't a bad night for British talent, with no fewer than 6 Brits picking up awards. Chief among them was Tilda Swinton, who won Best Supporting Actress for Michael Clayton. She was joined by home winners including costume designer Alexandra Byrne, as well as animators Hugh Welshman and Susie Templeton, who won for their animated short of Peter and the Wolf. It was joined by 3 awards for The Bourne Ultimatum. Best Song went to Irish success story Once, whose leads, Glenn Hansard and Marketa Iglova, received some of the loudest applause of the night for their rendition of Falling Slowly.
Jason Solomons. And today you can listen to a special Oscars podcast from our Film Weekly team. That's at guardian.co.uk/film. Last night, Tottenham Hotspur won their first trophy in 9 years. A goal in extra time from Jonathan Woodgate helped Spurs beat Chelsea 2-1 and lift the Carling Cup. The Guardian's chief football writer, Kevin McCarra, watched the match at Wembley.
We are used to seeing Chelsea in command and invulnerable, but they were broken by Tottenham Hotspur. The game was very close, with Spurs winning 2-1 in extra time, but nonetheless, the panache of Wandy Ramos' team and the desire to overcome a stupid free-kick goal they conceded to Didier Drogba in the first half was noteworthy, and it may tell us about the trends in English football. After that, Spurs showed a lot of pace, which Chelsea couldn't really cope with and couldn't really find a rhythm. And eventually, in the panic, Chelsea conceded a penalty. Dimitar Berbatov equalised for Spurs, and Spurs went on to win in extra time through a bizarre goal when the Chelsea goalkeeper punched the ball against the head of Jonathan Woodgate, who, when he wasn't being lucky like that, was the man of the match, stopping the Chelsea forward line and Didier Drogba in particular. These are severe questions now for Chelsea. This is not an important tournament in itself, but they are not used to being treated like this. Conversely, Tottenham may be on the way to getting themselves among the elite, if not this season, then next.
Kevin McCarra there at Wembley. And now on Guardian Daily, a new form of political interview. I'd like to see perhaps Andrew Marr or Jeremy Paxman trying this. The Guardian's Helen Pidd spoke to the Prime Minister of Denmark, Anders Fogh Rasmussen, as he went jogging.
It's a miserable day in Copenhagen. It's just above freezing. The winds are blowing. It's raining. I'm standing outside the Prime Minister of Denmark's summer retreat called Marienborg. I'm waiting for him to put his trainers on. We're about to go for a run. Anders Fogh Rasmussen has just picked me up. He's wearing all black. We're about to head off for a run round a lake in this northern suburb of Copenhagen. Now, this run is not actually as random as it might sound, because Mr. Rasmussen has form in this department. In fact, running, and running with ordinary people like me, is one of the ways in which he won his third term at the Danish elections at the end of last year. So when you have foreign foreign leaders coming to visit you, do you always try to entice them to come out and do some exercise with you?
I would very much like to, and sometimes it happens. I have done the jogging trip around the lake, like we do now, with one of my colleagues. Occasionally, I do other sorts of physical exercise with colleagues, skiing, biking, things like that.
And is it true that you've been on this run with Silvio Berlusconi when he was in power?
No, not Silvio Berlusconi.
Just crossing the road. I read that.
You heard that?
Yeah.
No, that's not true.
I think Gordon Brown's been having a difficult time recently.
Yeah.
Do you think he should do more sport and maybe invite ordinary people to come out?
I haven't discussed this with Gordon Brown. I don't know how much he does concerning physical exercise, but in general, I would say that it gives you, I feel, it gives you strength physically as well as mentally. A sort of surplus. A mental surplus. The better your physical condition, the more patience you have. And as a politician, you need patience.
And do you ever come out on runs without the bodyguards? We're being followed now by one very lean looking young bodyguard.
Yes.
And another one ambling along on his bike. Is that always the case? Do you have to have security when you're running?
Yes, always. But I think they enjoy it because it's also a great opportunity for the bodyguards to keep their fitness.
Yeah, I will stop.
God, I feel out of breath just listening to that. That's Helen Pidd reporting. And you can find out how long Helen managed to keep running and talking at the same time and marvel at George Bush's mountain bike skills at guardian.co.uk/G2. Last year, Radiohead released their new album In Rainbows online, and they let their fans decide how much they paid for it. It was like a bomb going off in the music industry, according to one insider. But could a similar pay-what-you-like system work in another industry? The Guardian's Sam Jones reports from Poole in Dorset, where Penn Central Restaurant is allowing its customers to pay whatever they think their food is worth.
Basically, the menu starts with you getting the bill before you've even ordered. You order the food you wish to eat, and you fill in what you think is fair for the meal you've had, the service you've been given. Obviously, you pay for your drinks as normal, but basically the food is what you think it's fair for what you've sort of eaten, the quality and the service you've got. Instead of asking us for the bill, we ask you for the bill. Mm-hmm.
How are you guys feeling? A bit nervous tonight? Or?
Very nervous. There's lots of people in, and pressure's on to see if it works, I guess.
How many diners are you expecting tonight?
There's 30 covers minimum tonight.
So then, nerves at the front of house, but backstage, head chef Jamie Carpenter was calmly oiling the bruschettas. He told me how long he'd been cooking.
For about 10 years almost.
And have you ever thought of doing anything like this, the way the menu works this evening, or is it something a bit special?
No, it's just something a bit special that the owner, Mick Callahan, he decided he wanted to try out, just see if we could get more people in the restaurant, see how the food goes and get people talking about it, really.
And does this put more pressure on you, people deciding how much they're going to pay rather than paying the conventional menu price?
Not too much, but it'd be interesting seeing what people actually think about how much it's actually worth to them instead of us giving the prices to them.
And what did the customers make of it? A little after 9 o'clock, I met Jess Young and Chris Clifford and asked them about their payment strategy.
We discussed it quite a lot, but I think part of the point of it is when you come into a restaurant, you don't always feel like you're paying for service and you're paying for your surroundings. It's just taken for granted, whereas this evening we actually had a really good chat about what we were paying for.
So, I mean, you've both gone round about the sort of £5 mark for starters. Is that what you'd normally pay if you went out for a meal?
Gone slightly higher because of the presentation and the quality of the produce.
Are you going to come again?
Yes.
One of these nights?
Well, definitely. When my mum and dad visit, I'm going to bring them here and impress them, hopefully.
So it looks like a winning formula as far as the customers are concerned. But I asked Mick Callahan, whose idea it was, if the notion had really been based on Radiohead's decision to release In Rainbows and allow fans to pay whatever they thought the record was worth.
It was like we were talking about, and also, to be fair, I did hear that Cliff Richard did the same thing as well.
I'd go with Radiohead.
It's a bit cooler, isn't it? And also, I was looking at some websites, and they were talking about it in Australia. It's a big thing in Australia.
You sound very confident.
We talk about, you know, that society being a bad society, but the majority of people in this country are fair people. And people want to go out and have a good time. And if you give them, you know, good food, good service, or a nice place, people want to actually, you know, pay for that. They don't want to have to go somewhere where it's bad service and complain about it. All we're doing is we're putting the cards on the table and saying, well, here it is. You know, if you don't like it, don't have an argument with this. Just put down what you think. It's good for me because the chefs are good, and it's good for them to experiment with the menu as well. It gives them a chance for a bit of free rein to try different things that they, you know, they want to try out. And that's good for us because it'll give us an indication of what works, and we'll put that on our Friday, Saturday menus as well.
And is this a one-off stunt, or is it something you're keen to let's continue?
No, I think we'll continue it. It would be lovely to think that we could open it up and do it every night of the week.
Sam Jones reporting from Penn Central Restaurant in Poole. Guardian Daily's producers today were Scott Corley and Tim Mabey. My name's John Dennis. Thank you for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.